Welcome to today's edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show podcast.
We are entering into day 10. It is now day 10 of the conflict between Hamas and Israel as Hamas continues to shoot their rockets into Israel, and the pressure begins to build or continues to build on Israel to somehow set forth a ceasefire. Welcome. It is great to be here with you today as your guide host on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Want to invite you to be a part of the conversation at 800-282-2882. Later on in the program, we've got thoughts on aliens. And, of course, we'll talk also about cicadas. But the main threat right here in front of us right now is this increasing pressure coming from the Biden administration on the administration of Bibi Netanyahu there over in Israel. USA Today reporting in these last hours, in his most forceful statement yet on the Israel-Gaza conflict, President Joe Biden told Israel's prime minister he expects a significant de-escalation today on the path to a ceasefire. Biden has been quietly ramping up pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in recent days to end Israel's bombardment of Hamas targets in Gaza amid mounting international alarm over the rising death toll and growing demands from Democrats in Congress for a ceasefire. So the Democrats in Congress, Speaker Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, they're calling for a ceasefire, and they're pressuring Bibi Netanyahu to deliver that ceasefire. As you hear in that beginning of that quote, in his most forceful statement yet, Joe Biden told Israel's prime minister he expects a significant de-escalation today. What happens if Hamas doesn't de-escalate? What if Hamas keeps shooting rockets? Who is pressuring Hamas to knock it out, to shut this down? Who is pressuring the Palestinian terrorists in southern Lebanon firing rockets into Israel? Who is pressuring these? Are we relying on the mullahs in Tehran? Is John Kerry talking again to Javad Zarif? Who is he talking to? And why is it that Bibi Netanyahu is the one that's supposed to de-escalate when the rockets are coming in from Gaza? Rush talked about this beautifully. The notion of the Middle East peace process and how that Middle East peace process should be working out. Here's Rush.
The whole idea of Middle East peace as a diplomatic solution, it's impossible. There will never be one. And I'm glad Kushner said so. I'm glad he's realized it. Kushner is very young compared to all these other diplomats, and he's way ahead of the game here. But look at what we've had to put up with. We had Jimmy Carter and the Camp David Accords, and we've had Clinton bringing Arafat and all these players to the White House. We've had everything under the sun. And it's one of these things that never ends. No matter who the president is, no matter what party runs Washington, or runs Congress, I should better say, this is a thing that is just part of Washington that goes on and on and on, to which there will never be a solution. And yet it is something careers are made of. It is something that people have invested in for all kinds of reasons other than solution. And everybody plays along. The drive-by media duly reports every phase of the latest round of talks, ideas, negotiations on Middle East peace. What is Middle East peace anyway? What is it anyway? Is it still the Palestinians versus the Israelis and a Palestinian state? What is it anymore? If we achieved Middle East peace, what would be the result? What would happen? I don't think anybody can even tell you anymore. But the one thing I know, this is a conflict that goes back to the beginning of time. It is a biblical religious conflict that does not have a diplomatic solution. Not a single side in this dispute is ever going to surrender because somebody talks them into it. There's never going to be. And I have to think that all these people play in this game have to know this, which is why it strikes me as a gigantic phony exercise. We've got experts on Middle East peace. Whenever a mortar is launched in the Middle East, they're brought out to television to analyze what it means and what's going on. We don't need any of that. We know that it's a never-ending conflict. People that pay attention to it do. But there hasn't been a conflict like this that has ever been solved with words, with the Red Cross, with environmental policy. It's just never going to happen. The only way, and I've said this before, it's nothing new. The only way this is ever going to end, it's like every other conflict ends. It's only going to end when someone loses militarily and surrenders because of it. But nobody wants to start a war over this, not a permanent war. I mean, we've had Israel under attack. They've defended themselves, and they've been savaged and criticized for having the audacity to win each of these attacks that they've suffered. Israel continues to be portrayed as the problem in the area, and this is the whole thing that sustains all of this. But it's never going to end, and there are people that don't want it to end. Middle East peace, the strife has become too profitable. It's become too valuable to a lot of people's careers and so forth. So I'm just saying that it's refreshing. I don't care if it was a leak that made it happen. It's refreshing to hear Jared Kushner say there may be no solution to the conflict in the Middle East. There isn't, not the way we've been going about. Where's the evidence that the way we've been going about it for the last 50 years has a solution? There isn't any, not a shred. Because you're never going to convince one side to quit and give up. Can I give you the best evidence ever? Bill Clinton was so desperate to be seen as the president who brought peace to the Middle East. He offered Yasser Arafat everything Arafat was demanding and threw in some goodies. What did Arafat do? Canceled his trip. He didn't want any part of it. Arafat didn't want the solution. He was given everything he had been demanding. He didn't want it. Didn't want the solution. Didn't want to end the strife. It's never going to happen. Kushner sees it. It's a good thing. Well, then what is the solution? Maybe there isn't one. Maybe certain things just are the way they are. Maybe there isn't a solution. Maybe what is just the way it is. And you manage it. But this, Middle East peace, I mean, it's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. Everybody's been tackling it the identical way. Nobody's ever made any headway in it, not really. At some point, you stop beating your head against the wall, except they don't. They continue to beat their heads against the wall, and people profit from it, and their careers advance on the basis of it. And we're all misled that there is a solution out there this way. Kushner at least says that there isn't.
Now, we know, looking backward across the Trump administration, when you get the Abraham Accords put into effect involving Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, you had a side agreement going with Morocco, you had a side agreement going with Sudan, you have an agreement going with these states that would otherwise be troublesome for this Middle East peace process. What it took from President Trump by doing the Abraham Accords was this. He looked at the problem from a different perspective. As Rush said, what is Middle East peace? What is Middle East peace? And how do you impose an external peace, a peace on a part of the region that has seen strife for the better part of 5,000 years? You can't do it. So what do? You take it one piece at a time. You establish these Abraham Accords. So you get Bahrain, you get the UAE, you get Sudan. You know, the Saudis were willing to play ball because they all viewed the real threat in the region as being Iran. That is a fact. Iran is the real omnipresent threat. For 50 years before you get to the Abraham Accords, what do you have? You have American foreign policy chasing the Palestinian answer. And all the Palestinians knew that they had to do was to act out, take hostages, fire rockets, commit a terrorist act in the middle of Tel Aviv, or in Jerusalem or any place else, and they could absolutely sideline the peace process. So what did Trump do? What did Kushner do? They came in and they said, okay, let's work from the outside inward. Let's work regionally to get individual agreements between Israel and these other countries that might otherwise be difficult at the United Nations. And let's then see what happens when the only peace left is Hamas, is the Palestinian issue. And what do you see? You see rioting, you see attacks, you see a drama at Al-Aqsa. You see all of that happening. Why? What's happening simultaneously? This is not happening in a vacuum. Simultaneously to this, the American delegation is in Vienna looking to capitulate to the Iranians, to pay them off to get back in the JCPOA. The Iranians are the funders for Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. So the answer to this is pressure on Iran. And what do you have? You have the Biden administration in real time looking at Iran and saying, yeah, we'll transfer you money. We'll get you what you want. We'll give you what you need. And you could just tell us you're going to be part of the JCPOA. What do we think is going to happen when they get sanctions relief? Where's that money going to go? Right back to the Palestinians, and you're going to be back at square one. And the Iranians will now have a new weapon at their disposal. Not a nuclear weapon per se, but a weapon that they can use, which is we're threatening to leave the JCPOA. We're going to proliferate. We're going to enrich uranium if you don't give in to the Palestinians, if you don't give in to Hamas, if you don't give in to any of these folks. Now, the Europeans have shown who they are for a very long time, but only recently have we seen who they really are. Anti-Semites, when it comes to this diplomatic problem involving Israel and Hamas. Once again, I ask, who is pressuring Hamas to play ball? I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on The Rush Limbaugh Show. I am Brett Winterbull. I am your guide host today on The Rush Limbaugh Show and the EIB Network. So over the weekend, there were massive protests and demonstrations in places like Spain and in France and in Portugal, I believe. You've also got protests taking place in London. Not a surprise, because London is oftentimes referred to as a very, very aggressive hotbed for radical Islamist ideology. The Finsbury Park Mosque comes to mind. We have seen these places export a large amount of anti-Semitism, anti-Israeli sentiment out into the streets of London and beyond. And in fact, remember, we all recall very sadly the murder of Lee Rigby, the British soldier beheaded in broad daylight on the streets of London as people looked on. Well, there was a very frightening protest, frightening in how open and honest these protesters were there in the streets of London. Here is audio of some of that protest. It's one man talking on the streets of London as a British Muslim about what needs to happen with Israel.
The solution, very simple. Jihad, we have armies, we have tanks, we have soldiers. What are they waiting for? How dare they occupy Masjid al-Aqsa? How dare they? We, the Muslims in the West, we are with you. Very soon you will see this. You will see this Ummah's response very soon when we remove these dictators, the tyrants. We don't fear anyone but Allah. We don't fear the United Nations, British government. We don't give a damn. We only fear Allah.
So what he says is, very simple, jihad. That's the solution. We have armies, we have tanks, we have soldiers. What are they waiting for? How dare they occupy Al-Aqsa? How dare they? We, the Muslims in the West, are with you. Allahu Akbar. Very soon, Allahu Akbar, you will see this again. You will see this Ummah's response very soon when we remove these dictators, these tyrants. We don't fear anyone but Allah. We don't fear the United Nations, British government. We don't give a damn. We only fear Allah. So tell me again how do you have a ceasefire conversation with this guy? People ask me, who's the commander of Hamas? The commander of Hamas is a guy that the Israelis have been trying to kill since the 1990s. His name is Mohammed Daif. Mohammed Daif. And he is somebody that they've tried to knock off consistently since the 1990s, and he continues to survive. Literally, he is a man who has lost all of his limbs in battles and in attempted assassinations by the Israelis against him. So he's in a wheelchair, and he's taken care of by the senior command of Hamas, and they move him from place to place. He is the commander. That's the boss. That's the guy who runs the operation. His name is Mohammed Daif. Daif means guest in Arabic. So he is an omnipresent guy. He's an omnipresent guy. And it's a very complex situation, especially when you have people in the streets of London who are out there calling for more revolution, more violence. It's unbelievable. Rush spoke about politically incorrect truths, and here's what he said.
Newt's comment on the Palestinians. Oh, ho, ho. Has that ruffled some feathers? This is Newt on the Jewish Channel cable network. Correspondent Stephen Weiss interviewed Gingrich, And this is what Newt said about the Palestinian people.
There was no Palestine as a state. It's part of the Ottoman Empire. And I think that we've had an invented Palestinian people, who are in fact Arabs, and were historically part of the Arab community.
Oh, fuck, that is lighting dynamite. That's lighting dynamite and throwing it in a crowd of liberals. Oh, I know, it's 100% true. Golda Meir said the same thing. Numerous statesmen and women have said the same thing, but the conventional wisdom is something different now. The Palestinians are a historical people, and they are living in an historical place stolen from them. I mean, that's well, they should go to Jordan. They should go to, yeah, not just Jordan, other places too, but there never was. There's not a race of people called the Palestinians. It just, there never has been, and Newt's right about this. But they exist as a foil for the other. I mean, I tell you who sells the Palestinians out all the time is the other Arabs. What happens to the Palestinians, basically what they do to themselves, is what the rest of the Arab terrorist world points to and says, see, that's why the Jews are so bad. Look what the Jews are doing to our people. And, of course, you need that to keep happening if you want to keep blaming it all on the Jews. Newt starts off explaining that he was right about it.
Is what I said factually correct? Yes. Is it historically true? Yes. Are we in a situation where every day rockets are fired into Israel while the United States, the current administration, tries to pressure the Israelis into a peace process? Somebody ought to have the courage to tell the truth. These people are terrorists. They teach terrorism in their schools. They have textbooks that say if there are 13 Jews and 9 Jews are killed, how many Jews are left? We pay for those textbooks through our aid money. It's fundamentally time for somebody to have the guts to stand up and say, enough lying about the Middle East.
Okay. That's one of these, I mean, dead-on truth again. But the truth's politically incorrect because it's so threatening to people. Upsets apple carts.
What stops people from fighting? What is the number one thing that can stop people from fighting? I'm not talking about bombs. I'm not talking about a military solution. I'm talking about the thing that stops people from fighting is trade. In the post-war model in Europe, what did you have take place? Obviously, we had the Marshall Plan. We rebuilt Europe in the wake of World War II. But what emerged afterwards? In the West, you had a trading bloc. The Germans were trading with the French. They were trading with the English. They were trading with the Italians. Trade, countries that trade with each other don't go to war with each other. We don't go to war with Canada. We're not going to war with Mexico. We don't go to war with Japan. We fought them in a war, rebuilt them, and they are a large trading partner for us. Look at Dubai, the jewel of the Middle East, wealthiest part of the world, in that part of the world, right? Dubai. You look at Gaza. Gaza is a coastal area. You've got amazing beaches. You've got a beautiful opportunity to develop that. I'm sure if Hamas would put down the rockets and stop bombing Jerusalem, stop bombing Tel Aviv or Lod or any of these places, that the Israelis would look to trade with them. In fact, when the Jordanians tried to send in aid earlier today, Hamas shot at the aid workers from Jordan. The answer to this is capitalism, free market models, nations trading with each other, but not the kind of trade you would think. Jeff in Tampa, Florida, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Brett, you are executing guide host duties flawlessly.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
A question from the class here at the Limbaugh Institute of Advanced Conservative Studies. Mm-hmm. Where are the rockets that Hamas is firing on Israel built? Are they Russian missiles? Are they Iranian missiles? I'm thinking the answer to this question would completely change the discussion in the Middle East right now.
Okay, great question. I'll answer it because we're up against a break. And thank you for your kind words, Jeff. They are originally Iranian missiles. There's a belief that they have about 8,000 of them, okay? They have been, over the last number of years, building those rockets themselves in Gaza. So they're not being shipped in on boats or, you know, over the desert. They're making them themselves. That's how advanced Hamas is. We've got plenty more straight ahead, including electric vehicles and what Joe Biden has had to say about a number of other things, plus your phone calls. I am Brett Winterbull. your guide host today on the EIB Network. It is great to be here with you. 800-282-2882. Electric cars, the great savior of America. That's the sales pitch being made by people like Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, and of course, President Biden and his environmental crew. The White House environmental justice advisors are expressing opposition now to nuclear and carbon capture projects. They want to get us to zero net carbon, and they want to do it as quickly as possible. When are we going to have a truce between the environmentalist justice advisors and the people of America who just want clean, efficient, affordable energy? President Biden pushed the U.S. electric vehicle revolution yesterday there in Michigan, a state governed by Gretchen Whitmer, who is seeking to shut down another pipeline. Well, yesterday, during a visit to Ford Motor Company's electric vehicle plant in Dearborn, Michigan, President Biden called for the United States to become the world leader in electric vehicle production.
They think they're going to win, but I got news for them. They will not win this race.
Define win. Define win, Mr. President. The White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, I didn't know such a thing existed, expressed opposition to nuclear and carbon capture projects, as well as projects that expand capacity for fossil fuel production, in a report issued on Friday. Now, the Volunteer Advisory Council listed such projects as among the types of projects that will not benefit a community in a set of recommendations issued to the White House. This is a classic example of a why do we care circumstance. Here you have a volunteer advisory panel putting out their own report at odds with the administration that asked them to be volunteers. And they're even more extreme left than the administration in power, which is saying something, really. Now, this story from The Hill points out the kind of time being wasted with this advisory council, Environmental Justice Advisory Council. I mean, what are we doing? Well, here's Rush pointing out the ignorance of Michael Moore when it comes to electric cars.
You know, this idiot Michael Moore does all these ludicrous movies. He's out with a new film that the media will hype. Most Americans, like all the rest of his movies, will never see it. This is a Reuters story, and they are promoting this clown's latest movie. And he says that, like many people, he thought electric cars were a good idea, quote, but I didn't really think about where the electricity to charge them was coming from. I read something like this. Can this guy really be this dumb? And then I have to conclude, yes, I think leftists are this, maybe dumb is not the right word, ignorant. And you finally ask yourself, what am I doing? Wasting my time trying to talk to these. Same thing with climate change, doesn't matter. You can have statistic after statistic, fact after fact, to refute everything they believe, and it doesn't permeate. Michael Moore has been running around for decades promoting policies that would wreck the economy. The energy people are out there. They're loving this. They're saying this is a great dry run. It's a great dry run for guaranteed universal income. It's a great dry run for shutting down the economy to save the planet, for reducing CO2 emissions. What's happening? The oil industry is a great, great forerunner to wiping it out for good. He said he had no idea when he plugged in his electric car, where did the electricity come from? In other words, he had no idea that it was coming from the power plant. He had no idea it was coming from coal. He literally says here, I assumed solar panels would last forever. I didn't know what went into making them, meaning what a drain they are on the environment to make. Now, if we believe this, the guy's just flat out clueless. And if we believe it, which would make sense to do, we'll find out just exactly how blockheaded the people on the left are that we're dealing with, and that we're going about dealing with them in the entirely wrong way. We can't deal with them logically because they're not using any semblance of mental acuity to arrive at whatever they believe. Electric cars are powered by oil, natural gas. The big one is coal, because most power plants still rely on coal and natural gas to provide you electricity.
And they hate nuclear power because of one movie, the China Syndrome. They hate it. You cannot get through to them and tell them, based on what you believe, nuclear is the absolute only source that you should be relying on. It's completely safe. It doesn't pollute. It regenerates. It's renewable. But no, because there might be a meltdown. Jane Fonda movie. You tell them how toxic the batteries are in their electric cars and how they have to dispose of them when they wear out, and they won't believe you. And it's a problem. It's a problem when, you know, we conservatives, the ones that are actively involved in stuff like this, I don't know about you, I've arrived at my celebrated points of view by way of genuine intellectual application. I've debated myself. I've debated others. I've questioned. I've researched what other people say. I have sought, in other words, to honestly, legitimately, mentally confirm what I believe. There's not one part of that equation that applies to most people on the left that you would run into. Average, ordinary. Toms, Dicks, and Harrys out there on the left, they don't get anywhere near any kind of mental process that involves thinking, critical thinking, analysis. They don't get to what they believe by doing, because they can't.
EV batteries come from. Raise your hand if you know where most of the electric vehicle batteries are manufactured right now. China. They're manufactured in China. Now, you watched the video. No doubt you saw it with President Biden in that truck, in that Ford truck yesterday, driving around, an electric truck that has an MSRP of about $70,000. So absolutely in line with the folks that are making a combined income of $100,000 a year, right? The firefighter and the cop, the teacher and the firefighter, right? Your working class people from Scranton who sit around the table and talk to each other, right? That $70,000, that's easy. Let me just write the check right here. So those EV batteries come from China. And what's interesting about the American environmental left is that they're always okay with environmental degradation and pollution as long as it takes place in another country. They didn't care about the oil. Remember Tom Steyer? Where'd he make all his money coming up? He made all his money in the dirty, filthy carbon oil fields coming out of the Middle East. The left never cared about that. The Democrats never cared about the pollution in the Middle East, the pollution in sub-Saharan Africa, and they make these electric batteries in China as a majority source. Now, we're going to bring them here. What will happen? You'll have lawsuits to prevent you from opening an EV battery factory. Why? Because it's going to be an environmental threat. I mean, it's really maddening. You can go round and round the mulberry bush with these folks. And the fact of the matter is, they don't see the lack of logic in their mindset. As Rush said, you know, where does the electricity come out? Oh, it's clean. It's from coal. Or nuclear. Well, we can't have any of that. All right. Sail-powered cars? Anybody? Anybody? Just put a big old sail on the top of the vehicle and just ride on down the highway? It's like magic. You know, cell phones are like magic in a lot of ways, right? Rush enjoyed all that a cell phone could do, and that's an understatement. He saw the phone in his hand as a small-sized computer with a phone app. It was the access to information and e-commerce on a cell phone that Rush was most intrigued with. But how do you use that much data without getting a huge monthly cell phone bill? You switch to PureTalk with a flat $30 a month charge for all that. When Rush discovered PureTalk last year, he detailed it out for us. It went like this.
You shop for the best price you can find on insurance, on home mortgages, on vacation travel, maybe even cheeseburgers. I don't know. So why not do the same thing with cellular phone service? Your cell phone number is your own, and who you choose for cellular service is all up to you. One company makes such a compelling offer, it's worth thinking about. It's PureTalk. They offer you unlimited talk, text, and 6 gigs of data for just $30 a month. And guess what? If you go over on the data, they don't charge you for it. PureTalk. Compare that monthly price, $30 a month, to your current cell phone bill, and you'll see why it makes sense to change. Now, I don't know what your cell phone bill is, but I would wager you that it's $60 or more, maybe $120, maybe $75 or more. This outfit, Pure Talk, is offering you unlimited talk, unlimited text, and 6 gigs of data for $30 a month. Now, Pure Talk knows they're in the same business with the likes of AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile. In fact, get this, they use the same cell towers of one of the big companies that covers 99% of the country. They offer superior service. 100% of the Pure Talk customer support team is right here in America. So you make one phone call to them today, you can start to save money by switching to Pure Talk. All you do is get your cell phone and dial pound 250. Next, you say Pure Talk. It's that simple. You'll save 50% off your first month. That's pound 250 and then say Pure Talk. One of the Pure Talk customer service people will be right there on the phone to help you. And by the way, it's legit. $30 a month, unlimited talk, text, and 6 gigs of data.
Plenty more straight ahead. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Well, the answer is in regarding Joe Biden's expectation that Bibi Netanyahu will need to, significantly ratchet down the drama between Israel and the Hamas forces. Benjamin Netanyahu's response to Biden, quote, Israel is determined to continue this operation until the goal is achieved to restore peace and quiet. As we speak, you've got rockets going back and forth from Hamas and into Israel. And Bibi Netanyahu has just signaled to the rest of the world that he's not much interested in Joe Biden's policy prescriptions. Wondering if the squad had any effect on that. Wondering if the squad had any effect on Bibi Netanyahu's decision to not partner up with Biden on this call for a ceasefire. I mean, after all, it was Rashida Tlaib who called Israel an apartheid state. You've had AOC, Ilhan Omar, the rest of the squad all calling it apartheid. It's disgraceful. It is disgraceful the way this is playing out. And make no mistake, that is a very strong message being sent to the broader Middle East by Benjamin Netanyahu, that he's not much on taking Joe Biden's policy positions, given the fact that Joe Biden's crew is sitting down with the Iranians as we speak, trying to figure out a way to pump more money into their regime. More on that straight ahead. Vinny is in Fort Wayne, Indiana, joining us now. Vinny, welcome to the show, Vinny.
Hey, thank you for having me. Hey, first of all, thank you guys for doing a great job of keeping Rush alive with all of us.
Thank you.
You know, when you sometimes go to the radio and you hear that beginning, you hope you hear his voice.
Oh, I know that.
Like waiting for a phone call from a lost family member. You know, you kind of look forward to it, but you guys are doing a great job.
Thank you, sir.
My question is this. I've been on this earth since 1968, and I don't know that there's ever been a year where there wasn't a conflict in the Middle East.
Right.
And what do you see as a solution? Because it seems every 4 years, something pops off, and then there's a conflict, and then it calms down, and it happens again.
Right.
Is there a solution, or is this just going to be the cycle that we live with our entire life?
Well, you know, it's a cycle until the people who are participating in the cycle decide that they want to go in a different direction. I don't think we can enforce an external peace upon the region, and I think that was sort of what Rush was talking about. This has gone on for thousands of years. The Israelis have a right to respond when they are attacked. I imagine, as another drive-by caller mentioned, Vinny, who called into the program earlier, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu could go on TV and read all the ceasefires that have been broken in the last 45 years. It'd probably go on for days and days. I think this is a cycle until people decide they don't want it to be a cycle any longer. Jimmy Carter was able to broker the Camp David Accords with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin. They wanted to have peace. It was achieved. There are successes, but it's up to Hamas, which is a terrorist organization, to want to come to the table. I don't see them wanting to do it.
So how much of the Iranian money that was given to them went into those Hamas rockets?
I think a substantial amount. It's been spread all over. The Iranian militias in Syria, certainly Hezbollah controls much of Lebanon. This is a regional problem coming from the Iranians. They are the malign actor behind all of this.
You know, I guess we really miss Trump now, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff, Vinny. I appreciate you calling in. And I have that exact same feeling that you talked about, that feeling of expecting to hear Rush right out of the box. But he left for us so much timeless information, left for us the Limbaugh letter, left for us rushlimbaugh.com and 24/7. You know, these are all outlets and vehicles that we can continue to use and learn from. And that's what is so important about the contribution that Rush made. In fact, the new podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, is now available to listen to. You can go get it right now, Vinny. Every episode will share more stories of our beloved Rush by those he worked with, his friends and family. Tunnels to Tower Foundation and MyPillow are the sponsors. James Golden is the host, and if the first episode is any indication, this is a must listen. I hope you get a chance. You can check out that very first episode. Head on over to rushlimbaugh.com. There's a link there. You can download it. You can listen to it. And then you're going to want to hear the other 11 that are going to be following after that. It is phenomenal. I'm Brett Witterbull. Happy to be here with you today as your guide host on the EIB Network. Brett Witterbull, your host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Coming up in hour number two, what about the aliens? What, did you leave me hanging there?
You know, folks, every science fiction movie in the 50s, the 60s, was based on space aliens coming to Earth to prevent us from developing the nuclear bomb. Remember, Michael Rennie was in the original The Day the Earth Stood Still, that stupid robot, Gort, whatever it was. It was all about, we're developing a nuclear bomb. Now, the aliens are going to get us to stop doing global warming. And this gets passed off as straight news.
The aliens. But it's not the kind of aliens like you would expect, like, you know, the border issue, because that doesn't matter anymore. That's not national security or anything like that. But it's the space aliens, and the way the space aliens are going to get us focused properly on the climate change issue, as Rush talked about. We're going to let you hear that. Also, in a matter of moments, we're going to take a bit of a dive into what it is that's going on in the Attorney General's office in the state of New York. They're thinking they've got something pretty big to talk about. We will certainly unpack that and explain that and give you the context for all of that, plus take your phone calls at 800-282-2882. Brett Witterbull on the EIB Network. Hour number two underway. Amazing to watch the narrative that has unfolded in the last 24 hours. Back on the home front here. Nothing to do with the border security. Nothing to do with the pipeline shutdown. Nothing to do with the exploding inability to hire people for work. But the thing the media cared about the most in these early morning hours today, whether it was CNN, MSNBC, they were popping the champagne. They were celebrating because the big news came out that New York Attorney General Letitia James has told the Trump Organization that she has opened a criminal investigation of it. Oh, wow, that's huge. She's expanded her capacity to look into a potential criminal investigation of the Trump Organization. No, nobody's been indicted, arrested, none of that. But New York Attorney General Letitia James is joining the Manhattan District Attorney's Office in a criminal investigation of the Trump Organization. James's office said on Tuesday, the Attorney General's office and their investigation into the Trump Organization, which has been underway since 2019, will also continue as a civil probe. So they'll go criminal and civil. But the office recently informed the Trump Organization of the criminal component. How is that news? How is that screaming headline news on the morning chat shows this morning? Quote, we have informed the Trump Organization that our investigation into the organization is no longer purely civil in nature. We're now actively investigating the Trump Organization in a criminal capacity, along with the Manhattan District Attorney. That's according to Letitia James's spokesman, Fabian Levy, telling CNN, we have no additional comment. Well, as CNN notes, it's an increasingly serious sign for former President Donald Trump. The Attorney General's office is working with the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, whose wide-sweeping probe into the Trump Organization has looked into whether The company misled lenders and insurance companies about the value of properties it paid and the appropriate taxes. You know, Letitia James is also investigating Andrew Cuomo for abuse of power and the mistreatment of staff. What this all comes down to is pretty clear. You've been seeing an increased presence of former President Trump out there in the conversation. The cable channels are desperate to talk about anything but Joe Biden at this point because he is flailing so badly. And as a result, they want to go back to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump and MAGA won't go away. Here's what Rush had to say about it.
I know they desperately want Trump gone, and I know that they desperately want it codified that Trump cannot run again, because make no mistake, they remain scared to death of you, and they remain scared to death of Trump. Trump, 75 million, 80 million votes. And I'm going to tell you, you're not going anywhere. Even if Trump does, you're not. You know what you believe. You know what your vision for the country is. You're not going to give up on it. You're not going to go packing away. They remain scared to death of you, folks. They remain scared to death that there are 75 to 80 million of you. And that no matter what they've tried, they can't separate you from Trump. And more importantly, they can't separate you from the ideas. They can't separate you from MAGA. They can't separate you from Make America Great Again, which I think remains one of our big campaign strengths going forward. The idea that making this country great is somehow bad. The idea that making America great, either again or in period, is something controversial, to me, is a big plus in our column. I think we're nowhere near reaching that point where a majority of Americans think America being great is a problem. It remains an objective for millions of people. It remains a goal because it means so much to people in their real lives. Most Americans do not think America is the problem in the world. A number of Americans do. They've been brainwashed in public education and in higher education, not denying that they're out there. But a majority of Americans, no. Make America Great Again is a concept of ideas rooted in the founding of our country, the writing of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and it remains the bulwark. It remains the definition of America, both in terms of morality and virtue, decency and politics, that people want to strive for, and they're not going to give it up, whether Trump is around to lead it or not. And that's what really bugs them. Here's Teresa. Teresa, Coconut Creek, Florida. Great to have you on the EIB Network. Hello.
Well, hi, Rush. I'm very emotional and quite honored that I'm having a chance to talk with you, since I've been listening to you since 1988. The answer as to why Trump supporters are not going to go anywhere is because we are not Trump. Trump is us. Like, we believe.
Amen. Amen. Bingo. You're exactly correctamente.
Well, thank you. And by the way, I can think like this because I've been listening to you since 1998. And you are the one who, we couldn't believe that our nation was under this kind of control. It's hard to believe. It's not in our DNA. We believe in capitalism, freedom of thought, respect for one another. And the last 5 years have truly shown us with our own eyes what this left party is all about, and it's the destruction and deception of all truth and destruction of everything that we believe in. And it's hard to swallow. It's hard to believe. It's hard to understand, but because of you and your tenacity and your straightforwardness and the mayor of Realville, you have walked us through the last 5 years in seeing that this is who they are, and we are not going to go away because we still believe in everything that Trump has represented for us I believe he will continue to represent us in whatever capacity.
You're right.
Is.
You're so right on the money, Teresa. I came along. You believed what you believed in 1988. I didn't talk you into anything. In 1988, you already knew what you believed. I came along, and you rejoiced. You said, finally, somebody on the radio, somebody in national media who thinks like I do. It wasn't somebody on the radio making you think things you'd never thought of. And it's the same thing with Trump. Finally, somebody in the Republican Party sounded like you. Somebody, there was some running for office, running for president in the Republican Party who was an echo of you and millions like you. This the media has yet to figure out, and if they know it, they're in denial. The Democrat Party can't figure it out. They believe that they can destroy this bond that exists between you and Trump if they somehow make Trump look bad, make Trump look like a reprobate, embarrass you about Trump. They can't do it because you came before Trump. And the real question is, who's going to pick up the mantle from Trump? Who are people like you going to get behind? They are scared to death of that. Florida GOP leader, the Trump name and the Republican Party is stronger than it has ever been. You may not believe that. You may be paying attention to drive-by media. You think they're in the process of destroying Trump. Get your mind right. That isn't true, folks. Grassroots support for Trump holds fast, and it's going to hold fast until there's somebody else that these people can go to. And Trump wants it to be him, by the way. He don't want to go anywhere.
And most importantly, you're not going anywhere. You're not going anywhere. We do know, we've been seeing the reports that are moving, that President Trump intends to get out there, get back on the rally circuit, do a number of events. And I think that is going to be the surest contrast between what it is that's going on in Washington, D.C. right now as they continue to hide behind the razor wire and the fencing and all that sort of stuff. You have no way to redress your grievances in Washington, D.C. They've still got that city in lockdown, essentially, if you can even get in there because they're out of gas. All of this brought to you by Biden Economics, Bidenomics, the Biden plan, the Biden-Harris plan, the Biden-Harris-Pelosi plan. I mean, you look at the position these folks are in on the other side. Their biggest two news takeaways today are Letitia James is going to team up with Cyrus Vance's district attorney's office there in New York City and investigate the Trump Organization for, what is it, the 542,000th time? Okay. Wow, breaking news. They're investigating. But the other thing they've got is this idea that we're going to do this commission to investigate January the 6th. You know what they're not talking about? H.R. 1, gun grabbing. They're not talking about anything that's supposed to be the big drivers, court packing. They're not doing any of that. What they are seeing is a paralyzed executive branch and a paralyzed branch of legislators that are sitting there just panicked because they can't deliver the radical agenda that they promised the grassroots. If anybody's going to be demoralized right now, it is the progressive forces that are going to be demoralized right now. I guarantee you are ready to jump out and vote today. You don't want to wait till 2022. But their side is fearful because they understand that what President Biden and Vice President Harris are offering up is resulting in failure. And that is really early in the game to come to that conclusion. They are failing. Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Welcome back to the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. I am Brett Witterbull. All of Rush's wisdom, world knowledge, good-natured wit continue on each and every page of Rush 24/7 at rushlimbaugh.com. Use Rush 24/7 to find out what Rush said on any topic. Listen to entire shows or watch them on the Ditto Cam through the vast audio and video archives available exclusively to Rush 24/7 members by using the search function on the site. You can join at rushlimbaugh.com, choose a monthly subscription, or lock in a full year. Be sure to download the app at the App Store or Google Play. Rush is always there for you at Rush 24/7 because it's important to have access to that site so you get the context of what it is that's going on out there in the world today. The left continues to freak out about their masks. I'll tell you, it's a depressing thing to look at. The way the panic is setting in with people when they realize, no, it's time to move away from the mask. Well, you've got the headlines from The Hill: mask rules spark confusion and tensions in Congress. Nancy Pelosi's yelling and screaming at Republicans who don't wear their masks. The New York Daily News says, don't throw out that mask yet. Masks should remain with us, becoming part of our everyday lives, even as the COVID-19 pandemic, science willing, subsides. We should never fully return to our maskless society where only healthcare providers don a mask, because the judicious use of masks will continue to save lives. CNN tells you, to help address social needs, it is our view that we should continue to feel comfortable interacting unmasked and in close contact with those of our pod. Tell me about your pod. A small number of family and friends who explicitly agree to a similar level of mitigating behaviors, such as always wearing masks and maintaining social physical distance around those outside the pod. Stick only with your pod. Your pod. Great. We now have COVID cliques forming, and they're supposed to continue. Rush had it spot on when he said the mask is a symbol of fear.
Don Salinas, California, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mr. Limbaugh. Let me first thank you for your courage and inspirational voice in this corona mess. I really appreciate it. And I would like to put this observation that I have. You know, the visual representation of how devastating this virus is never appeared. The truckloads of dead bodies never really happened. The overflowing hospitals with people dying on the sidewalks outside never really happened. So now the curve is flattening, and they're desperately looking for some way to show us how bad this disease is. So all of a sudden it morphed from being a hand-to-mouth disease to the coronavirus is an aerial ninja, and you need to put a mask on when you leave your house to when you come back. And the main reason I can see for this is it's the only visual they have of this virus being dangerous. And if you say, I want my life back, please give me my job back, they'll say, no, can't you see? Everybody's wearing a mask. It's dangerous out there. It's dangerous.
So let me make sure I understand your theory. Your theory, the mask, everybody wearing masks, is about the only sign they can make us use to create the impression that there's a silent, deadly killer out there. And so
that's it.
Everybody's got to wear a mask. And by the way, I have heard, I've seen members of the drive-by media, by the way, very supportive of the idea that the mask may become a permanent aspect of American public life.
It's insane. If you remember at the beginning, it's wash your hands, don't touch your mouth. Then all of a sudden, no, this thing is, it'll fly around corners and jump in your mouth and you'll die.
Oh, yeah, the videos of how it spreads across supermarket aisles when you're buying frozen peas.
Yes, it's insane. This is like the flailing of
how
these people.
How dare you laugh during this time of national... You're laughing out there while this is happening. I can't believe you. No, I'm just kidding. The mask is the symbol of fear. The sign that you're at risk, the sign nothing is going to get better. A note from Mr. Snerdley. Can you explain to me why TV people doing outdoor shots with nobody nearby are wearing masks? The cameraman's the only person nearby, and they can be over 6 feet away. I think it's precisely to create the image of fear. They're wearing a mask because either they legitimately are afraid that that virus is lurking out there and it's racing through the air and targeting them, or because that's how they've been ordered to behave by their boss. I mean, if the people that employ you tell you to wear a mask out there, that's what you're going to do. But it is clear that the mask is a symbol of fear. And when you see various people suggesting that we may now have masks as part of our public lives for the rest of our lives, why? You know, why? What happened to the simple question of why? We've had pandemics before. We've had runaway viruses, and we've had highly contagious and virulent viruses. We've not done this.
The thing that's most striking to me about the mask enforcement sort of provisions of our life for the last year would be the complicity and compliance with which big companies and retail establishments and restaurants, that role that they played in pushing this narrative. Because if the supermarkets, if the big box stores, if the restaurants don't say to you, you must not come in unless you have a mask, well, that's the logical choke point, because government has no power to come in and make you put a mask on as you leave your house. I mean, they literally have no power to do that. So they turn to the companies and the corporations and to the social media outlets and to the universities. You think back to when the sports programs were first canceled. It was Harvard University. It was the Ivy League that started the shutdown of sports. And it was the corporations and the companies and the retail outlets who enforced the masking projects. Because they had no way to otherwise enforce you to put the mask on. Fauci couldn't come to your house and duct tape it to your face. So they had to get people that were going to be the local enforcers, schools, airlines, those sorts of things. This has been an interesting dry run to see how it is you can control the people of the United States. I cannot remember, looking back across my life, and I've been alive for a while, a generation as fearful as this current generation. The World War II generation wasn't like this. Vietnam generation wasn't like this, where people were genuinely walking around panicked and fearful. This is the first generation to demonstrate that. COVID-19 was a terrible thing, but I don't believe that we should become a panicked generation clutching our masks for the rest of our lives. Coming up straight ahead in the next block, we're going to talk about aliens. Aliens and climate change on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Have you seen the video of the UFOs? It's pretty wild stuff. Aliens and climate change and aliens. Look, a newly leaked Navy video appears to show an unidentified flying object disappearing into the water off of California. It's according to a clip obtained by a documentary filmmaker and shared with NBC News. The video was captured in July of 2019 by Navy aircraft and recorded in the USS Omaha's Combat Information Center, according to filmmaker Jeremy Corbell. The clip appears to show a spherical object flying above the water for a few minutes near San Diego before it vanishes. In fact, according to 60 Minutes, UFOs are regularly spotted in U.S. Airspace, restricted U.S. airspace, and they've looked at a number of instances in which that has happened. Bill Whitaker reported on the regular sightings of unidentified aerial phenomenon. Remember, it used to be UFOs, now it's UAPs. Unidentified aerial phenomena, or UAPs, that have spurred a report due to the Congress next month. Well, while that's happening, the Federalist has a piece, U.S. Army takes on climate change as a serious threat to national security. So given the recently released government claims, the Senate's Marco Rubio has asked for a report from the Pentagon on the official understanding and findings of a series of UFOs off the Atlantic coast that have gone from Virginia to Florida in the last 3 years by members of the U.S. Air Force. That's what they're looking at. So we've got unidentified airborne phenomena. We've got UFOs flying into the ocean off of San Diego. And now we've got the U.S. Army getting ready to tackle climate change. Well, look, Rush spoke about this, said scientists, not aliens, may destroy humanity to protect themselves.
The U.K. Guardian, serious story. Aliens may destroy humanity to protect other civilizations, say scientists. May not rank as the most compelling reason to curb greenhouse gases, but reducing our emissions might just save humanity from a preemptive alien attack, scientists say. Was that idiot Krugman advocating for a space alien attack in the New York Times as a way to get the economy to rebound? Yet a serious story here in the UK Guardian. Watching from afar, extraterrestrial beings might view changes in Earth's atmosphere as symptomatic of a civilization growing out of control and take drastic steps to keep us from becoming a more serious threat. Researchers explain the highly speculative scenario
is one of several described by a NASA-affiliated scientist and colleagues at Penn State. I'm reading this verbatim. While considered unlikely, they say could play out were humans and alien life to make contact at some point in the future. Sean Goldman of NASA's Planetary Science Division and his colleagues compiled a list of plausible outcomes that could unfold in the aftermath of a close encounter to help humanity prepare for actual contact. In their report, would contact with extraterrestrials benefit or harm humanity? Basically, you have here a crackpot leftist scientist and influence in NASA coming in the form of an actual NASA employee producing actual NASA documents warning that if we don't adopt lunatic global warming policies of Al Gore's, that space aliens will invade us to wipe us out, to prevent us from destroying our climate. Here's a quote from the story. Folks, this is in the UK Guardian. This story is presented with all the sincerity of any news story that you might find on the front page of any newspaper any day of the week. Here's the pull quote. Green aliens might object to the environmental damage humans have caused on Earth. Wipe us out to save the planet. These scenarios give us reason to limit our growth and reduce our impact on global ecosystems. It would be particularly important for us to limit our emissions of greenhouse gases, since atmospheric composition can be observed from other planets, the authors write. Honest to God, NASA scientists say we're being observed by space aliens, and if we don't dial it back on the greenhouse gases, they're going to invade us and wipe us out as a civilization to save this planet. We're being observed. You know, folks, every science fiction movie in the 50s, the 60s, was based on space aliens coming to Earth to prevent us from developing the nuclear bomb. The nuclear bomb, we're going to wipe ourselves out. Space aliens, always smarter than we were, would show up, and that was the plot. Remember, Michael Rennie was in the original The Day the Earth Stood Still, that stupid robot, Gort, whatever it was. It was all about, we're developing a nuclear bomb. Now the aliens are going to get us to stop doing global warming. And this gets passed off as straight news.
You know, what's incredible about this, and speaking of aliens, by the way, tomorrow we're going to have Rush talking about the time he met with aliens. Because he did. He's going to be talking about the time he met with aliens. And you can actually see a picture of this over at the website, rushlimbaugh.com. He's going to dive into that tomorrow, and we're going to let you hear it. Let's go down this weird rabbit hole that's been created by these scientists. How do we know the dinosaurs were wiped out by a meteor? And don't they always say, like, a meteor struck the planet or an asteroid struck the planet? It wiped out the dinosaurs, you know, 35 million years ago, whatever the number was. How do we know that that was an asteroid or a meteor? How do we know that wasn't a space alien weapon deployed against the United States? Because, I mean, are you kidding me? Cow farts are bad for the climate? What do you think Tyrannosaurus Rex and Brontosauruses are doing to the planet? Stegosauruses, all of those. What are you? They're eating all that grass. They're eating all those trees. They're eating each other. It's entirely possible the space aliens looked at those dinosaurs and said, gotta go. Gotta save that planet. Gotta go. Boom. Boom, down go the dinosaurs. I mean, that could happen. Boom goes the dynamite. Boom goes the asteroid. I mean, that could have been the case. I read an article a couple of weeks ago that said, you know, these frequencies we keep pumping out in outer space, trying to reach out and make contact with whoever's out there. There are credible experts who have said, we have no idea what we're saying to these people or to these aliens. We may be taunting them. We may be putting out something that is as offensive to them as you can say to a guy from Gort or whatever it is. We have no idea what we're saying to these aliens. Not a clue. It's also possible it's the other way around, that they may be interpreting them as, well, I guess we got to go take that place over. I mean, when you start messing with space, you know, we don't know the fineries of that world. We have no idea what we're doing. So, you know what? I'm after listening to Rush and then thinking what these scientists are saying, maybe that the takeout of the dinosaurs was, that was a trial run for what's going to happen next. You want to be sure you know what's going on when you're making big decisions that have long-term effects, right? You hear a lot, see a lot of messages from mortgage companies offering you great rates, but how many of those companies, right, had heard Rush's endorsement? One, American Financing. If and when you're interested in refinancing your mortgage, be in touch with American Financing. This is the company that puts your needs first. American Financing is a family-owned mortgage lender that customizes loans for both new home purchases and refinances. Depending on your situation, you could save hundreds, if not thousands, a month. Rush has the details.
As a homeowner, one of the activities you don't want to miss out on is accessing lower interest mortgage rates. Because a lower rate can mean hundreds of dollars in monthly savings. That's tens of thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. So please, make today the day you call American Financing and get the refinance process started. Now, you'll work with a dedicated mortgage consultant, someone who's going to guide you through the custom loans, helping you pick the right option to achieve your goals without any pressure. No upfront or hidden fees either, because they only want what's best for you.
Start saving on your mortgage by calling American Financing. Here's the phone number. Rush always shared it with you. 800-795-1210. That's 800-795-1210. Or visit AmericanFinancing.net. NMLS 182334. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. 800-282-2882 is the phone number to be a part of the conversation. I am Brett Witterbull, your host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Now, before you you step on a plane, you may want to step up on the scale. It's not just your suitcase that needs to meet weight requirements these days. That's right. U.S. Airlines may start weighing passengers at the gate. Getting weighed before getting on an airplane after taking off your shoes and belt and jacket. The next natural move anyone wants to make when running through the airport to catch a flight, right? Well, this happens outside the U.S., by the way, with a lot of regularity. It's another invasion, government takeover of your health care. If the TSA knows how much you weigh, the government does too, right? TSA is a government agency. Rush talked about a similar case just a few years ago.
Have you heard about this Japanese airline? I mean, the news out there. So we got this Japanese airline is requiring people to go to the toilet before they get on board to reduce weight so that they can save fuel. They want you to go in and eliminate your weight. Here, I've got the story right here. Airline asks passengers to use toilet before boarding so they weigh less and help cut carbon emissions. The Japanese airline started asking passengers to go to the toilet. All Nippon Airways claims that empty bladders mean lighter passengers, a lighter aircraft, and thus lower fuel use. I'm not making this up, and I'm going to tell you something. I'm looking at a picture of the paint job of an all Nippon Airways jet. Why don't you strip the paint off the thing? I'll guarantee you the weight of the paint on your stupid jets weighs far more than the waste yet to be eliminated in the bodies of your passengers. It's insane. It's insane out there.
It's wacky. And he's right. So U.S. Airlines may want to start weighing passengers at the gate. Can we at least get a BMI reading, too? I mean, just because you're heavy doesn't mean you're fat. Doesn't mean you're unhealthy or obese. And by the way, let's think about this for a moment. What are we talking about? What time of year are we going to be weighing people? Are we going to be weighing them in the summer when they're a little more slender? Are we going to be weighing them when they get back from vacation after they've been boozing and carousing and eating everything in sight? I mean, how are we going to work this out? And by the way, will there be a sliding scale? Identity's got to play a role in this. Identity plays a role in everything now. Will some people be allowed an extra 10%? Will some people have to give up 10%? I mean, this is eventually going to create a sliding scale of something. There's going to be a chart that the person's going to have to. They'll be like, well, okay, you're 100. Let's see, you're 186 pounds and you're 5'2", but you're in this group according to our statistics, so you're within the region of a fair weight. You don't have any privilege, so you can weigh whatever you want. This is all going to happen. I mean, you know this is going to happen. We're going to a very, very weird place. But Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania is not a very, very weird place. It's a great place where Mike is calling in today. Mike, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show. What's on your mind today?
Well, I appreciate you taking us. You've got a national audience, and we have a national scandal that slipped under the radar. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the opportunity to share it. Because of the teachers' unions and the weak early men superintendents of schools, mm-hmm. the public education has jettisoned from the curriculum cursive. Mm. And if you are to show a letter to any student today, unless he's a parochial school, he or she, parochial school or private school, they cannot read. They cannot write cursive. If you talk to a superintendent, they'll say, well, it's a waste of time. They're not going to need it. Well, take a letter out in longhand and let them, one of the students, grasp it. They will not. They will
That's
struggle
right.
and struggle. And you talk about losing your ability to just be a educated person.
Sure.
This is a scandal, and I can't blame the soccer moms. I can't blame Republicans or Democrats. It's not that issue. It's an issue of weak superintendents, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. a powerful teachers union, and people too busy to mm-hmm. understand what their kids are learning or not learning in school.
It's a huge point.
Period.
It's a huge point. You're exactly right. Look, if you were to take one of these skulls full of mush, right, as Rush would say, and hand them a copy of the Declaration of Independence or an original copy of the Constitution, they may make out a word or a letter here or there, but by and large, they cannot read what is going to be written there. And it's a lost art because there are going to be documents that are written that way, old letters that have been written through history, that sort of stuff. But it's tragic to see the sort of things we're jettisoning in favor of addition to the curricula that have absolutely really no value to a longer term bit of knowledge for these students. It's a great point, sir. I appreciate you calling in. We'll certainly keep an eye on that. I'm Brett Witterbull. This is the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Cicadas. The cicadas are coming. No, I'm serious. Check it out. This is Rush coming up in the next hour. We're going to be talking about cicadas.
Most liberals want to live in a fantasy world of a potential utopia that's just around the corner. And they construct these little cocoons in which they live. And if you come along and poke a hole in it, you are not enlightening them, you are threatening them. And they respond in kind. They're not rooted in reality.
We've got plenty more of that straight ahead on the program. It's going to be awesome. I am somebody who is fearful. I am fearful of the cicadas. And we're going to be talking about that. Plus, we're also going to be diving a little deeper in a couple of these other things. And you know what else we're going to have? We're going to have our high note as well. Let's jump out very quickly and check in with Michael in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Michael, welcome to the program.
This is John.
John. Okay, well, let's put John back on hold and hold him over into the next hour. Because I think my board is malfunctioning here. We will certainly come back to John. Look, there are no updates coming here out of Gaza. The demand for a ceasefire by President Biden has not produced any results. It's incredible to see an American president basically not able to achieve what it is that he is attempting to achieve, which is a broader peace in the Middle East. That's what happens when you have a group like Hamas continuing to bomb civilians on the EIB Network. From the Queen City to you, I am so happy to be here spending this time with you, and it is wonderful to be with Rush's audience. Our phone number to be a part of our conversation, our discussion, all across the fruited plain, 800-282-2882. this is an incredible time to be alive for a lot of reasons. It's also a terrifying time to be alive. If you're somebody who is, say, bug-averse. That's right, bug-averse. Remember when the drive-by media got liberals to vote for Biden despite his cognitive decline? Well, now those same drive-by media want you to eat bugs. The Washington Post, Axios, Wired, among the other drive-bys, are all suggesting you go out and eat the brood of cicadas that are expected to come out this summer. It's not the first time the left has tried to get you to eat the bugs, but let me give you a little background on this before I let you hear from Russia's analysis. The cicadas that we're talking about are the Brood X or the Brood 10. For 17 years, trillions of cicadas known as Brood X have tunneled through dark soil, feeding on sap as they slowly matured babies during the George W. Bush years. These long gestating underground bugs are now starting to hatch across the eastern United States, emerging from the earth in astounding numbers. Their time above ground will be short, 3 to 6 weeks. Can't be short enough for me. Just long enough to mate and die. As a biological phenomenon, gigantic cicada broods are hard to ignore. They're like crickets with musical theater degrees. They're dramatic. They're loud. It is scary. We are talking about trillions of these bugs on the East Coast. Brood X offers something beyond noise and wonder. It also offers, according to Wired magazine, a source of free-range, no-cost, eco-friendly protein. Eating bugs. That just sounds terrific, doesn't it? Getting out there in your backyard and eating some bugs. Once upon a time, Rush talked about Kofi Annan. Remember him? When he wanted you to eat bugs.
Try this. Former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan wants people to eat more insects because it's better for the environment and your health. Keeping meat consumption to levels recommended by health authorities would lower emissions and reduce heart disease, cancer, and other diseases, Kofi Annan told the UK Guardian on Sunday. And, of course, there are alternative sources of protein. For example, raising insects as an animal protein source, he said. Insects have a very good conversion rate from feed to meat. They make up part of the diet of 2 billion people and are commonly eaten in many parts of the world. Eating insects is good for the environment and balanced diets. You think I'm making this up? This is the former head honcho at the UN who is suggesting, again, under terms of equality and fairness, egalitarianism, with the added benefits of helping prevent climate change and global warming, eat insects for your protein. What is it with these people? Seriously, what is it with these people? You hear a story like this. I mean, it happens to me, too. You hear a story like this that you think, aha, finally, one of these idiots has overstepped it, and now I can help demonstrate to my liberal buddies just how stupid what they think is, just how crazy what they believe is. So the next time I run into my liberal buddies, I say, did you hear what Kofi Annan said? And they'll say, who's Kofi Annan? Because they're liberals. And you will say, who's Kofi Annan? Why, he's a former Secretary General of the United Nations. He used to run the world at the UN. And they'll go, oh, the UN? Wow, cool. No, what did he say? He said the best thing that you could do to stop climate change would be to eat insects. Well, your liberal buddy is going to think you're lying, or that you have misunderstood, or that you are misstating what he said. They will not believe. They will think that you're lying to them or trying to entrap them. Even if they go on to learn that you've told them the truth, they will not permit what they believe to be discredited by you by virtue of some extremist little news item you've brought to their attention. They will come back at you and say, well, if you look at what he said, it said it's one of the things that we could do. And he pointed out that poor people have to eat insects. It doesn't mean you have to eat insects to save the planet. You can. But there are other things that you can do to save. And I do. I drive a hybrid. I make sure that I don't take a shower for any longer than 90 seconds. They'll come back at you with all of the great things they do to save the planet. And then they'll turn it around on you and accuse you of not doing anything because you don't care. I don't think you can shame these people. They have to come to these conclusions themselves. And even if what you tell them changes their mind, they're never going to give you the satisfaction of knowing that you did it. They're not going to say, wow, is that right? Man, well, he's an idiot. They'll find a way. Most of these people change their mind. Now, I do have, and it's been demonstrated, I do have the ability and power to force liberals to see the light and change their minds. Many of them over the years have called here and admitted it, acknowledged it, and even thanked me. But most of them have to do it on their own. Something happens and they learn it with a stimulus maybe or something that somebody said to them. But I found most of them rigidly positioned, unalterably positioned, rooted in their belief system because their belief system is not really what they believe. Their belief system has been constructed as a way of shielding them from what really is. Most liberals want to live in a fantasy world of a potential utopia that's just around the corner. And they construct these little cocoons in which they live. And if you come along and poke a hole in it, you are not enlightening them, you are threatening them. And they respond in kind. They're not rooted in reality. I mean, who could be? I mean, who in the world would actually think that it's a good idea, for example, to ban moms and dads reading to their kids at night because it's not fair, they can while others can't? I mean, what must you be? What must you think? How must you think if you believe something like that's a good idea? That's why I say, look, the ultimate objective here, and it's getting harder and harder every day, not bring them in the fold. That isn't going to happen. What has to happen, they have to be defeated. They have to remain the minority they are. And that's proving problematic because we don't have a political party right now that wants to push back against much of this.
I'm not eating cicadas. I'm not eating bugs. And I know there are cultures who eat bugs. That's great. That's what makes the world an amazing place. Everybody's got a different sort of taste for things. I imagine there are people who were horrified the first time a guy grabbed a lobster out of the ocean or a clam out of the sand and busted it open and ate it. I imagine that probably worried some people who didn't know what that was. But this idea that we're going to eat cicadas? No. No. To me, if we're down to eating bugs, here's the thing. We have overfished the oceans, right? That's what the progressives always tell you, the environmentalists tell you, overfished the oceans. We'll probably overbug the forests. We'll get such a delicious taste for cicadas, we won't be satisfied. We'll be down to beetles, and we'll be down to cockroaches, and we'll be down to flies and mosquitoes. We'll never satiate ourselves enough. I mean, this is terrible. I don't think the American people need to be turned on to this new flavor. I think this new flavor will be so attractive, we'll just end up wrecking it. So why don't we save the cicadas for everybody else? In all reality, I'm not eating a bug. I'm already worried because I'm right here in the Carolinas, and I'm telling you, there are going to be millions of these things everywhere. And I'm going to probably go find my old snow shovel in my garage, and I'm going to shovel my way to my car to get in my car and drive. And the idea of trillions of bugs flying around and having a barbecue, I'm not barbecuing bugs. They're doing these pop-up food menus in Washington, D.C. where people are going to eat bugs. Not interested. 0% interest there. I don't want any of that at all. John is in Springfield, Massachusetts, and was patiently holding on. John, welcome to the show. What's on your mind, sir?
Brett, first off, I want to thank you and the other hosts for the excellent job you do of continuing to bring us Rush.
Thank you.
So that he is and will continue to be relevant. And that's kind of what's leading into what I wanted to talk about is just before the break, maybe two calls before, you had a lady that Rush felt made an excellent observation.
Yes, sir.
And that is that the thing is Trump thinks like us. Mm-hmm. And there's only one thing that they hate more than Trump, or as much as Trump, is Republicans, especially here in Western Massachusetts. We hear it every day. So the problem is, and the editorial in yesterday's paper was in Springfield, was that they are upset with Republicans because they won't go away from Trump and the big lie.
Right.
We're not going to go away from Trump and the big lie because Trump thinks like us. Trump would have to leave us, just like Rush would have to leave us. Because so that's what really scares them, is they can't separate us from our level of thinking. And for instance, I'm not really one way or the other about whether Trump is right about the election being stolen. What I'm really big about is that the Democrats in key locations went out of their way to make the elections look fixed.
Well,
they did that, and we are stuck with that, and somehow or other we got to get our electoral process back. So we are not going to, I mean, even if we don't particularly like Donald Trump as a person, we like the way he governs, we like the ideas he governs by.
Right.
So and, he would have to leave us.
Well, and that's really the point, John, and I appreciate the call. It's about a party of ideas versus a party of ideology or identity. And what you're seeing are some pretty big ideas, and ideas that we have proven work, cutting taxes, the Abraham Accords in Israel, being strong in the face of challenges around the world. Those things work every time it is tried. And that's the lesson. That's the key takeaway as it relates to the former president. He's going to get back out there. He's going to be doing messaging. And I have a feeling that the drive-by media and their cohorts out through culture around the country are going to be panicked because they feel like they have dodged it for a while. They're about to start getting a big-time dose of critique. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show and the EIB Network. It is the EIB Network, the Rush Limbaugh Show. I am Brett Winterbull, keeping you company today as your guide host. Do you know what's coming up this Saturday? If you are any sort of a long-term student at the Limbaugh Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies, you know coming up this Saturday is one of the most iconic dates in Rush Limbaugh history. This Saturday is the 28th anniversary of Dan's Bake Sale. We have a special show coming up this Friday. You long-term listeners will know what it's all about, but for you new listeners, just think Woodstock for conservatives. It's going to be a really fun day. We hope you can join us. Here is Rush explaining Dan's Bake Sale, the Cliff's Notes version.
Dan's Bake Sale. It all got started when Dan called and told me his friend was making copies of the Limbaugh letter a copyright violation because his wife wouldn't let him buy a subscription. And he wanted me to give him a freebie. And, you know, these little kids are running around at that time doing bake sales, sending the proceeds to Clinton to retire the national debt. And Clinton was keeping the money and praising this as good civics. So that's where the bake sale idea came from.
And thus was born a legendary event. So coming up on the Friday show, we're going to take a deep dive and reminisce and bring you back to that magical moment again. This coming Saturday, the 28th anniversary of Dan's Bake Sale, and we have got tremendous, tremendous stuff prepared and ready for you. And certainly, we'll take your reminiscences as well coming up on Friday, your memories of it and what it meant. So stick around for that. It's going to be wonderful. John is in Miami, Florida. John, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I just want to say, first of all, you guys are doing a fantastic job keeping the Rush memory alive and moving forward with it.
Thank you, sir.
All right, I'm calling about the weighing people on the bags. I'm in the industry. I'm a pilot, and what I've been told is we have winter and summer weights for men and women in bags and stuff like that. And for instance, a man summer weight is 180 pounds. Anybody been on an airplane lately? We know that. There's no males in there that are 180 pounds.
Right.
Everybody's a little bit bigger nowadays.
Sure.
And they want to adjust the weights because of performance, not only cruise performance, more importantly, takeoff performance, single engine performance when there's a loss of an engine coming back around. And the weights need to be accurate. And what the FAA wants to do is they want to adjust the weights because they can see that Americans are a lot bigger nowadays, and they would need to collect some data. So that's why they're directing the airlines to weigh bags and weigh the people. Well, I'm not sure when it's going to be implemented, but it's coming soon. But with all that said, it is a government agency, and it probably will be used against us later in life.
So can I ask you this? Based on the weights that get onto the airplane, when you get into the cabin, can people be moved around because of their weight? If you have somebody that's particularly, obviously, very overweight relative to other passengers, will you reposition them someplace else on the plane based on how you're flying?
I have not seen that on an individual passenger, mm-hmm. but when you get to the smaller, like RJ jets, the small jets, they will move people as a group, like more over the wing or more the front, depending on what the CG of the aircraft is. I've not seen individuals moved because they have to be very big.
What has been the most challenging? Obviously, we've just come through this COVID situation. People are on, you know, they're on hair trigger in terms of temperaments and things like that. What's been the biggest challenge that you've seen, John, in this time period that you've been flying, say, in the last year?
Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, everybody's flights were getting changed, so people weren't happy about that because the airlines, they were canceling flights left and right. And once they came up with a new schedule, it was actually quite enjoyable for a while because there wasn't a lot of people in the airports,
Sure. Not
a whole lot of people on the airplanes. But as the people are coming back, do I have to wear a mask? Why do I have to wear a mask? Mm-hmm. I've been vaccinated or I've just tested negative for it. So you have to deal with those things. And that's probably one of the most challenging things I've seen.
Yeah, it's great to have you stop by on the program and help explain why it is we're doing the weigh-ins the way we are and the fact that Americans are changing and the old weight tables are out of date. We wish you happy travels in your profession, and I look forward to seeing you up there in the blue skies, my friend. It's John from Miami, Florida, checking in. That's a lot to pick in there. I mean, really, we have to understand that these folks are trying to do a job, and they're trying to keep us safe, and they're trying to work, and we've got to be compliant as well. I'm just going to make sure I'm on a satisfactory weight loss regimen before I get weighed in on a plane. Derek in Medina, Ohio. Welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
So I wanted to point out that with this whole climate change argument, you know, it's an example of how the left will pick and choose the science to fit their narrative, and that photosynthesis. Now, I know I must be a heretic or a conspiracy theorist here to say that, you know, photosynthesis, the process by which plants take carbon dioxide and produce oxygen. You know, you have commercial greenhouses have carbon dioxide generators to increase their plant production.
Right.
So take away these harmful emissions and gases, and us breathing, where's the oxygen going to come from? It just reminds me of how, you know, Rush, you would often say, you know, even using the sun up in the sky, the sun as an example of, you know, the sun can influence the climate here. Think about how we get burned.
Sure.
But you can never bring that up in the equation.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's an incredible thing to think about the way the left uses science. To me, what has always astounded me is they refuse to believe that the climate can change. Okay, so the climate must remain static in their mind, but the Constitution, as written, is a living, breathing document. It's insanity. It means what it says, and the climate does change, but they think that they have the power through regulation and lawsuit and protest to change the direction of the climate on this earth. It's lunacy. Well, you know what else is? Woke Shakespeare. Straight ahead on the Rush Limbaugh Show. Woke Shakespeare. That's right. You didn't misunderstand me. Woke Shakespeare. The Globe Theater, you know, Shakespeare's theater, the Globe Theater there over in England is decolonizing the plays of Shakespeare. Wait a minute. Decolonizing the plays of Shakespeare. Well, the Globe, Shakespeare's Globe Theater, which works primarily out of a reconstruction of the iconic Globe Theater built by William Shakespeare's own company in the 1500s, is suggesting that webinars supported by Cambridge University Press were an answer to its own rhetorical question, what does it mean to read Shakespeare through an anti-racist lens? The theater, which declared that it is anti-racist and believes Black Lives Matter in June of last year, will put on its first webinar to discuss issues of race and social justice in A Midsummer Night's Dream on May 20th, hosted by Farah Karim Cooper. Karim Cooper is a professor of Shakespeare studies at King's College London, who curated the Globe's first Shakespeare and Race Festival. He has strong views on a lot of issues. He was relieved when Sadiq Khan was reelected as the mayor of London, tweeting about the inanity of Brexit and the monstrosity of Trump and white privilege and white male mediocrity and the heavy hand of white supremacy in academia, among other things. Okay. So they're going to put this on as an anti-racist play. It's really an amazing thing. The woke culture made its way all the way to that Globe Theater right there in Stratford-on-Avon. Can cancel culture kill Shakespeare? Back in 2017, Rush talked about the left hijacking Shakespeare for their own purposes. In that case, having a Trump lookalike is Julius Caesar.
Shakespeare in the Park. This is a big deal for the theater world. You might think this is off. No, this is not off Broadway. This is a big deal. And corporations love being seen. It's connected to this. You have to have lived in New York and understand the New York theater and arts and croissant crowd, coupled with the corporate culture. And it's how they all tell themselves and demonstrate to everyone else that they are cultured and sophisticated and supportive of the performing arts. Some of the finest and most valuable elements of high society. And so the actors work in there for not very much, and they do variations on Shakespeare plays. What they're doing now is Julius Caesar, who, of course, as you know, is assassinated by Eto Brute as he's walking into the Senate. Well, guess who's playing Caesar in this adaptation? An orange-headed Julius Caesar, made to look like Donald Trump, who gets stabbed to death and killed, and the audiences cheer. And it is clear it is President Trump being assassinated. So we know that the left enjoys watching a Donald Trump character stabbed to death on stage. We know that the left enjoys Donald Trump cut to pieces by 1,000 illegal leaks. We know that some on the left actually appreciated the art of Kathy Griffin's decapitation of Trump and that photo op. We know that the left, for the most part, will actively and loudly and proudly support the political assassination of Donald Trump. And as far as that goes, nothing is out of bounds. Nothing is out of bounds. If collusion won't kill Trump, if obstruction of justice narratives will not kill Trump's presidency, then let's kill it on stage. And we'll call it art. The political assassination of Donald Trump is art. It's all in the phrasing. It's good to see just how ugly the left is when their masks of acceptability and sophistication are removed. There's no nuance here. The media ignores hypocrisy when practiced by Democrats, but there has been an accumulation of double standards that may overwhelm the media and their elected minions, because these double standards are continuing to pile up on each other. You remember when Sarah Palin was accused of being responsible for the shooting of Gabby Giffords, and then I, secondarily, was similarly accused of this. Why? Well, on Sarah Palin's website, she happened to have a graphic of the scope and a rifle. And that scope hadn't arrived. That graphic happened to be discovered right around the time Giffords was shot. So the left and its willing accomplices are running out saying that Palin inspired the shooting. And Palin had nothing to do with it. And the left and the media excoriated her. And in any public shooting, be it a movie or a school shooting, the left first tries to find if the perp is a Tea Party member. Then they try to find out if the perp listens to talk radio. Then they try to find out if the perp watches Fox News. Then they try to find out if the perp voted Republican. They never find that out. The perps are always deranged, either apolitical leftists who love Democrats, or they're just insane lunatics. But they are never conservative right-wingers, listeners to talk radio, and they're never Sarah Palin acolytes. But the point is, Sarah Palin had nothing to do with Gabby Giffords being shot. And yet, when it happened, that's the only person the left blamed. Here, Donald Trump is assassinated every night in Central Park on the stage. And the left applauds this and says it's art and wants more of it. Kathy Griffin decapitates Trump, and there's some who think that went too far, but privately they're very happy. And she had her own supporters urging her and egging her on and applauding her. When the left actually portrays it, when they actually engage in symbolic assassination of Republican presidents, which they did frequently with Bush, it's applauded. It's great art. It's expanding the boundaries. It's testing the boundaries. It's courageous. It's hypocritical as it can be.
One of the things that's most incredible when you watch these leftists come out and do this sort of stuff, whether it's decolonizing Shakespeare's plays, or if it's reimagining or redoing Julius Caesar in the form of Donald Trump, it belies something about the left that I think people are not always really aware of, and it's this. They're not great creators. The leftists, they're not great creators. What they are, I mean, a lot of them are driven by nihilism, which is destruction for the sake of destruction. They want to be editors. They want to edit history. They want to remove names and statues and buildings and books and movies and plays and television shows. They want to remove them all from history, right? They want to decide, well, we're going to amputate that part of our culture, that part of our culture, that part of our culture. But they don't create very much at all. Like, they really don't create very much. You could easily write a bunch of plays that are anti-racist. You could easily write a bunch of plays that are anti-racist and take place back during the time of Shakespeare. I mean, it's not creative. It's not creativity. If you were to do Romeo and Juliet and to have the Montagues and the Capulets and to say, well, you know what we've done? We've modernized it. And it turns out the reason why the families hate each other is a beef off of Facebook. There's a Twitter fight. There's an Instagram hate going on right here. And you know, we'll do this and we'll do that. They never go out and actually create anything new. They want to edit what exists and tell you that it doesn't meet their standard, but they never offer up a product that we can critique. They just expect us to either defend the original product or to critique their critique. And what we're doing is we're giving them a veto in that regard. Fine. You want to go and do these things? Great. Let's see you write plays, movies, stuff that is uplifting, empowering, worthy of celebration. Instead, they want to edit everything according to their taste. I get it. It's a lot easier to engage in subtraction than it is to engage in addition. And the reality is, with identity politics, it's all about division and subtraction. I'm Brett Whittable, your guide host today on the EIB Network. It is the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. I am Brett Whittable. Today's EIB High Note gives a shout out to GOP representatives Young Kim and Michelle Steele, the first two Korean American women ever elected to the United States Congress. The California Republicans represent the 39th and the 48th congressional districts and are committed to policies that will help build back their state, especially small business that has been decimated by the pandemic, and put pressure on the Biden administration to fix the crisis at the border. Both of their families immigrated to the United States when they were kids, and they had to learn English and essentially start over. The two women have been friends for over three decades, and Kim says she hopes to be an inspiration to others.
I'm just so grateful to be able to serve in this community as one of the first Korean American women to serve. And my story hopefully will be an inspiration to other immigrants, other young women and girls especially. I came here and I had to learn everything on my own. We have to assimilate into this country. You have to study hard. You may have to work twice as hard. But if you do that, you can achieve anything. Don't give up. Winners don't quit. Quitters don't win.
It's an incredible story of perseverance for these two young members of the Congress who come from immigrant families. These are the sorts of people that are illustrative in so many ways because they understand the process of legal immigration into the United States. Their families modeled that for them when they were young. Filling out the paperwork, going through the motions, doing the sort of things you have to do, double-checking that all of your information is accurate, waiting for the vetting process, getting your paperwork in order, all of that sort of stuff. Anybody could just gate crash. Anybody could just come running across the border and demand things. But it's that first effort in utilizing immigration the way it ought to be utilized, and that is to say in an orderly and legal way, to gain access to the United States of America. So many of us are so blessed to be born in this country. And I'll say it, to be born in this country at this time, because it is a country of endless opportunities. And these two young members of Congress, these two young women who are there proudly representing these districts, trying to save those districts from the ravages of Gavin Newsom and California socialism and one-party rule administered there in Sacramento, they're the ones who are out there on the front lines of this fight. I remember when I left California to come to Carolina to work here at WBT. And I just want to say something about that experience. There are so many great conservatives behind that blue wall in that state. You have to remember that the state of California produced more Trump voters than any other state in the United States in that election. And that's important to understand because there is hope and possibility there if you can only break the restrictions of the quasi-socialist pipe dreams of the mayors like, for example, Garcetti and London Breed there in San Francisco. California has so much potential, and it is sadly so mismanaged. California is something that is, in many ways, a blessed place, blessed by God with amazing natural resources and administered by people who are nitwits, people who do not understand that if you unleashed that engine of capitalism and free markets and opportunity, we'd be good for another couple trillion dollars of economic growth in this country. The world wants to go to California. And Gavin Newsom and the cabal of socialists that control it are more than happy to denigrate it and degrade it. And to see these two heroes, political heroes who are fighting to turn that tide, we should support them at every turn. We should always say to the people of California, we understand. You live under a regime that doesn't allow you to be totally free or totally prosperous. But we, the other 49 states, will stand and be your voice. They may not be able to get rid of Nancy Pelosi, but we can by building majorities out of the other states. They may not be able to get rid of socialists in one fell swoop, but we can turn the tide by moving the majorities. Got a final thought straight ahead. I'm Brent Winterble, your guide host on the EIB Network. Oh, final segment of the show. It goes so quickly. I'm so thrilled to be here. Brent Winterble, your guide host today. Once again, let me remind you, we have something very special planned for Friday, and it all began with a phone call from a guy named Dan.
Wait a minute. He's sending you his used Limbaugh letters?
Well, Xerox copies.
I tell you what, Dan, here's what we're going to do.
Okay.
You must organize a bake sale. Have a bake sale. Are you married?
Yeah.
Does your wife bake?
Well, yeah, but she hates your show. That's another reason I can't get the letters. She won't let us put the finances to it.
Oh, ho, 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 ho. And thus was born. Thus was born one of the most transformative moments in modern American political and radio history. Dan's bake sale. Coming up on Friday, we've got a very special program looking back at that incredible event when thousands, tens of thousands attended, and it was spectacularly received. And let's be honest, there were doubters. There were people who thought Rush wasn't going to be able to pull it off. They were all on the left. And when they saw what happened, absolutely unbelievable and triumphant, and that's going to be celebrated. We're going to be doing it on Friday. You're going to hear all kinds of phenomenal sound, memories, recollections. It's going to be terrific. I'll be back with you again tomorrow and then on Friday as well. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on this, The Rush Limbaugh Show, on the EIB Network.